I want to share on the parable of the Good Samaritan this morning. And I say that on the surface it seems all nice and warm and fuzzy, because on the surface it does seem all nice and warm and fuzzy. Is there anybody here who has not heard the story of the Good Samaritan? It's a good thing no one raised their hands, because I would have called you a liar. I mean, even in the public non-Christian school system, you have a Good Samaritan Day where everyone is encouraged to go do good deeds. Everyone knows the story of the Good Samaritan. I even had a friendly chat with a Jewish rabbi about this particular parable a few years ago. Everyone knows this story. It may be the most famous parable of Christ's teaching. Everyone knows it. So, in honor of that, because I know that everyone's heard it 1,000 times, I'm going to ask you to pretend that you've heard it for the first time this morning. Huh? Huh? Yeah, well, let's try that. I get everyone to turn to the book of Luke. The book of Luke, starting in verse 25. 10. Thank you, Lori. Luke chapter 10. Starting at verse 25. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. Teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? What is written in the law? Jesus replied. How do you read it? He answered, love the Lord your God with all of your heart and all of your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. You have answered correctly, Jesus replied. Do this and you will live. But he wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, and who is my neighbor? In reply, Jesus said, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he fell into the hands of robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. Look after him, he said. And when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? The expert in the law replied, the one who had mercy on him. Jesus told him, go and do likewise. This story is rich in first century Judean culture and context. And out of the gazillion, zillion, billion sermons I have heard on this passage, I was actually shocked to find that I was woefully ignorant, actually, in the context of this passage. I would like to share some time with you in explaining and going over the context of the story. And hopefully through this, we can draw out some lessons out of this. The first is at the beginning, where we have a lawyer, an expert in the law. Now, we think of lawyers today in terms of judicial law. In first century Judean culture, he would have been an expert in religious law. An equivalent today would be someone who holds a PhD in theology, an expert in scripture. He is an academic, is what he is. He is an authority on this. And those who know Jewish culture know that those men who went to go down that road memorized the first 5 books of the Bible, if not the entirety of the Old Testament. Memorized. Completely. I am not that good. So when Jesus asked him, what do you think the law says? This man was very competent and qualified to give him his response. And he quotes 2 scriptures in this. Deuteronomy 6:5, which is love the Lord your God with all of your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And Leviticus 19:18, which is love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus then says, go and do likewise. And then the man comes back, and this is a very interesting question. Trying to justify himself, he asked Jesus, who is my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? Now, on any normal day, I would have been quick to answer, well, that's anybody. I would have even brought out the song, and we can all sing this one together if you know this. This land is my land. This land is your land. From New Brighton to whatever it is. Right? This land is my land. It's your land. It was made for you and me. Everyone, we are all neighbors. My neighbors who live beside me, those here, you guys are my neighbors. This was not the understanding in Jesus' time. In fact, there was great conflict amongst the Jews as to how do you define who your neighbor was. If you go back to Leviticus 19, which the expert quoted, Leviticus 19, 18, where it says, love your neighbor as yourself. The verse before that says, do not harm a fellow Israelite. And do not be afraid to scorn or encourage or admonish your neighbor so as to prevent them from harm. So two verses side by side where to the Jews' understanding, God was speaking through Moses saying, do not harm a fellow Israelite, but instead do not be afraid to admonish your neighbor. The Jews felt it very well defined in that verse that your neighbor was exclusively a fellow Jew. And that was it. A Jew only. Now, there was obviously a lot of back and forth and argument, because if you go a little bit further in that same chapter, I think it's verse 34. God says in verse 34, it says that if you have a foreigner living in your nation, living in Israel, you are to treat him as if he is a Jew. But then there was argument back and forth, well, how do we define living? Is he visiting? Has he set up a permanent residence? What if he doesn't have a home? What if we burn down his home? Does it now qualify? It went back and forth. There was a lot of argument as to who is my neighbor. So this question that the lawyer asks is actually quite relevant. Who is my neighbor? And I think from the text, at least from the Bible's, from Luke's perspective, he wanted to justify himself. I think the lawyer knew that the spirit of the law was that neighbor extended beyond what he wanted. I think he wanted neighbor to be defined strictly and exclusively as a Jew, as an Israelite. I think he was asking Jesus, what is the minimum standard I must reach so as to meet the standard of the law? What is the minimum, the bare minimum? What's the least I might have to do? What is the smallest common denominator on the definition of neighbor that I have to find? And I was thinking, I think he was asking Jesus to confirm it and give him a pat on the back and go, well done. Good lawyer, you are loving your neighbor. You are loving your fellow Jews. But Jesus, knowing his heart, does not do what I would have done. I would have turned back to him and quoted Leviticus 19:34. I said, "Ha, you quoted that chapter, I will quote it too." And we would have gone into this nice big spiritual debate, and it would have been a back and forth, and we would have been arguing scripture all day long, but Jesus doesn't do that. Instead, what does Jesus do? He tells a story. He tells a story. Now, the Jews did not like foreigners. And I'm going to read a couple of quotes, and I got to actually go up and read these. Because Jewish literature at the time was kind of nasty. There was a rabbinical text in first century Judaism, and it quotes like this. Heretics should be pushed into the ditch and not pulled out. A midrash on the book of Ruth wrote this. If a Gentile is in danger of death, we are not bound to deliver them. If any of them fall into the sea, do not pull them out. There was a guy named Jesus ben Sirach, and he wrote a book of wisdom where he says this. If you do good, note to whom you do it. Give to the devout, but not to the sinner. Give to the humble, but do not give to the ungodly. For the Most High also hates sinners and will inflict punishment unto the ungodly. There was a text found near Jericho in a town called Qumran. And it said this, speaking on behalf of God. I shall have no mercy for those who deviate from the path. I will not comfort the oppressed until their path is perfect. So when the leader of the law came to Jesus and asked him, who is my neighbor? This is what he's reading. I should push Gentiles into a ditch, not pull them out. In fact, if God's not going to help the sinner until he straightens his own path and makes it perfect, why would I? And then he's wrestling with Leviticus 19. Who is my neighbor? And Jesus, piercing his heart, knowing him, answers with the story. The road to Jericho, the road between Jerusalem and Jericho, is a famous road. It has been there for a long, long time. So much so that the road that spans between those cities follows the lineal path that separates two bounds of land. One was Judah, and the other was, no, not Samaria. It was another one of the tribes of Israel that I just had a brainworm came in and took that one away. It is on this same path that David fled from his son Absalom. It is also on this same path that David hid from Saul when it said that he was hiding in caves along the path from Jerusalem. It was a famous road. And I want Micah to throw up some pictures for you guys to see. And I want to explain some of the peculiar aspects of this road. The road between Jerusalem and Jericho was extremely deserty. The Jerusalem sits at the top of a set of mountains. And if you go down those face of the mountains, you hit the Mediterranean Sea. Warm water would rise up in the air, hit Jerusalem at the top of the mountains and the Mount of Olives. It would drain all the moisture out, and then the hot moist air, or the hot dry air, came down the other side, down the slopes, all the way to Jericho. Between Jerusalem and Jericho, the further you went from Jerusalem towards Jericho, the more deserty and dry it became. Dry, hot desert. There was no life. It's a mountainous region, all dark and deserty. And once we get to that slide, you will see from a cross-section point of view that Jerusalem is 1,000 meters higher in elevation than Jericho. And the distance, if you were to draw a straight line, straight down, is 17 kilometers. You have a 17-kilometer hike with 1,000-meter descent. Now, Robin, being the avid mountaineer person that we know, would tell you that any hike that involves 1,000 meters is a pretty solid hike. Okay? And they didn't have nice paved paths that we have here. Here you can see Jerusalem on the far left at the top, the Kidron Valley and the Mount of Olives, which we know from Scripture fairly well. And then you go down into a couple of descent into the Canyon of Nahalog, and then you end up at another peak. At that peak there, it became famous for a couple of inns. It became really famous for the establishment of some forts. The Romans set up some forts there. The Crusaders set up some forts. In fact, the Roman Caesar sent a note to the encampment in Israel saying, under no circumstances is any soldier allowed to travel the road between Jerusalem and Jericho by himself, for it is too dangerous. The last one there on the far right from the Roman and Crusader forts down is called the Ascent of Adumim. The Ascent to Adumim is translated the Road of Blood. Now, there is some debate among scholars as to where the original name came from. It could be that in that particular spot, there is actually a lot of red rock and red earth. It could also just mean it's purely translated name, spots of red. But no one argues that that particular path from Jericho going up to that top peak was where you were at the most danger of being robbed. And there was lots and lots and lots and lots of documented death on that road. You were in danger from bandits. You were in danger from thieves. That road was narrow. It was nothing more than a goat path winding along the crest of the mountains. On one side was a sheer drop into the valley, and on the other side was nothing but desert. And on that particular stretch, because of the way that water flows through there, there is an infinite number of caves. Thousands of them. Ready for you to hide, which is why David could hide in caves and Saul had nowhere to, just by God's happenstance, God's providence, that Saul ended up in the same cave as David. In the same way, thieves took advantage of the same caves. They would hide, catch you on the road, beat you, take everything you had, and then run off into the desert. No one would chase them. It became known as the path of blood. It is on this road that Jesus sets the story. It is famously known. Jesus tells a story that one day a man was traveling from Jerusalem, or traveling on the road between Jerusalem and Jericho. We have to assume that he's on that particular stretch, as I think the crowd would have assumed he was on that stretch, where he was taken over by thieves, beaten, stripped of his clothes, and left half dead. By chance, a priest comes along and finds him. The priest was coming from Jerusalem on his way back to Jericho. Many priests lived in Jericho during this time. They would serve in Jericho. They would do their priestly functions in Jericho. But every priest was called every now and then when it was their turn to go up to Jerusalem and serve at the temple. That was their duty. An example of this would be Zechariah. In the book of Luke, if you read the very first few chapters, the father of John the Baptist. Where did the angels approach him? At the temple in Jerusalem where he was performing his service. He was one of these priests that traveled to Jerusalem to perform his priestly duties. And while at the temple, God spoke to him. This priest was finished his service and was coming back down to go home. A priest that meets a naked man half dead on the road. In Leviticus and in Deuteronomy, there goes to great lengths to describe what a priest needs to do to maintain himself to be ceremonially clean. A priest was not allowed to come within 6 feet of a dead body. He was even more so not allowed to touch a dead body. If he was to come within 6 feet of a dead body, he would have had to have turned around, gone all the way back to Jerusalem. He would then have to perform the 1 to 2 week ceremonial cleansing, which includes standing at the Wailing Wall and the East Wall. Then he would have to buy the ingredients and things that he would need to perform the ritual rites to make himself clean again, which took a whole week. And then once he was clean again, he would then have to travel this road again to get all the way down to Jericho. Now, there were no emails back then, no cell phones. Okay? So if this priest comes and sees this man, he doesn't know if he's alive or dead. He has no idea. He's naked. He's not, we're assuming he's breathing as he's only half dead, but he's not conscious. So what does this priest do? If he's not dead, well, then he can help them. But even then, he doesn't know, is this man Jewish or is he a foreigner? I read you those texts of how the Jews viewed foreigners. Do I even want to help him? Then some other questions. If I go near him and he is dead, I'm now unclean. I can't proceed to Jericho to perform my role as a priest. I'm no longer a priest. I'm unclean. So if he has family in Jericho, what are the thoughts possibly going through his head? Well, first is the inconvenience. He's got to turn around and go all the way back and spend another 2 weeks just to make the same trip down. He's got family in Jericho, we can assume. His family is thinking he should be just about darn near home. Right? They know that he left to go perform his duties. They know he should be returning soon. What if he goes and finds this man is dead and he has to turn around and spend another 2 weeks? What is his family going to think? What kind of worry will they be under? They will probably think that he got hit and caught by bandits on the road, and they will think and worry that he is dead. And we're not even talking about the inconvenience of cost. Time. What about his own life? I mean, if I'm coming across the road and I find a man naked and half beaten down but still breathing, I'm immediately looking around. They can't be far. My own life might be in danger. And if I got to touch him, rescue him, I might get lucky this time. What if I have to go all the way back to Jerusalem, cleanse myself, and I got to do the trip again? Will I be safe? Is my own safety
going to be there. I think that would be a concern. That would be a concern for me. I would be concerned. I would be immediately looking, where are the thieves? Can I still see them? The priest then turns and keeps going. A Levite then shows up. A Levite shows up, and I've seen a few videos of this road. That road is long and straight, and there is nothing. You can see for miles. It is clear. It may be possibly be assumed that this Levite saw the priest walk around this guy. The Levite might have just sat there and take the most reasonable course. If the pious holy priest will not touch him, why would I? Or maybe not why would I, but perhaps I shouldn't either. And then Jesus comes in with the Samaritan. You'll like this. The Jews had a nickname for the Samaritans back in first century Judea. They referred to them as the stupid people. The stupid people. And you doubt me. Some of you go, you know, that must be, you know, you're just joking. No. Let me read this one from you. That same Jesus ben Sirach, chapter 50 of his book. And I quote, "There are two nations that my soul detests. The third isn't a nation at all. The inhabitants of Mount Seir, the Philistines, and the stupid people living at Shechem. There are two nations that my soul detests, and the third, which I detest, is not a nation at all. The inhabitants of Mount Seir, the Philistines, and the stupid people." That should tell you exactly how much the Jews got along with the Samaritans. They hated each other, loathed each other, enemies to the deepest of cores. So when Jesus creates a story, and he doesn't use this word, but it is implied obviously by the title that we all use. When Jesus said that along came a good Samaritan, the Jews would have laughed. There is no such thing as a good Samaritan. That doesn't exist. What would happen if Jesus had reversed the story? What would have been the thoughts, let's say, if Jesus had started the story and say that there was a Jew going between Jerusalem and Jericho? Or no, there's a Samaritan. And the Samaritan got beat up and robbed. And the priest came by. And the Levite came by. And another Jew, just a regular good old Jew, came by and saw this guy and had compassion on him. And then Jesus would have said, well, who is my neighbor? And the guy would have probably sat there and looked at him and said, you know what? Yes, you're right. I should love my enemies. I should love my enemies as well. But that is not the story. No, one of the stupid people had compassion. One of the stupid people. The hero of the story was not a Jew. The hero was one of the hated Samaritans. And the Samaritan is the one that spends his oil and his wine and his money. And it wasn't as extravagant. If you read some commentaries, they will tell you that the Samaritan was extravagant in his love and his mercy. He spent money on wine and oil, and he definitely spent what would be equivalent today to maybe a couple hundred dollars at the inn, promising to come back and spend a little bit more. Maybe what's really extravagant is that he probably, realistically, probably put his life in danger. Robbers were probably nearby. But it wasn't this ridiculous, extravagant love. It was reasonable. It was reasonable. All right. And so Jesus tells that story. Around along a rocky, deserty road filled with bandits, along comes a good Samaritan, one of the stupid people. And shows compassion. And Jesus ends off and says, who then is your neighbor? Or who then should you emulate? And the Jew doesn't even have it inside him to say the Samaritan. He says the one who showed mercy. Couldn't even bring himself to acknowledge the man. He just, the one who showed mercy. What are some lessons that we can pull out of this story of the Good Samaritan? I think
think one of the first ones is this. Is that our compassion should be costly. It cost the Samaritan his time, his money, his oil, his wine, a few hundred dollars. But it cost something. Had the priest done the same, it would have cost him convenience. It would have cost him 2 more weeks. It would have cost him some worry and doubt with his family. The Bible goes to great lengths to talk about that as Christians, we should shoulder the burden of our brothers and sisters. Let me ask you this. Is it not contradictory to say, I am willing to shoulder the burden, or I'm willing to carry the cost, but only do it when it is convenient to do so? Is that not the point of shouldering the burden of our brothers and sisters? Is that it's not convenient? Most often it's not convenient for you. It's not convenient for me. It definitely wasn't convenient for the Samaritan. And there was a guy who put it this way. What would have happened in the Midwest, in the United States, had an Indian found on the side of the road a cowboy beaten, bloodied, and barely alive, picked him up, put him on his horse, and rode into Dodge City and dropped him off at an inn? There would have been blood to play. It would have been assumed that the Indian was the one that caused the damage. In this case, the Samaritan could equally assume that he was going to take blame for this and put his life in danger by dragging a Jew, bloodied and half dead, into an inn in Jericho. It was not convenient. Not at all. In the same way, Christ is saying, shoulder the burdens of each other's lives, but your compassion might be costly. And not in dollars and cents. It may be dollars and cents. I heard one guy, one preacher, he put it this way. He was telling the story about how his class, as a professor, they were sponsoring 2 children in Africa. And one of the students came up and said, well, why aren't we sponsoring all of them? And he said, well, we don't have the money for that. And then he stopped and goes, no, we probably do have the money for all the kids in this particular orphanage. But if we did that, we wouldn't be able to afford your Starbucks now every day now, would you? And then he put this grin on his face and he pulled a bow and arrow and pew, said, I hope you had your guilt shield up for that. You know, it's just this thought of, we can go all the way to the other extreme. I heard one saying growing up in Bible college, it was this. When you get to ministry, don't be surprised when you hear the board say, God, you keep him humble and we will keep him poor. There are extremism that you can take this thought that your compassion must be costly and go to that. It's way extreme over there where for some reason everyone thinks that you must sell everything you have, live dirt poor, and give everything you have to the poor. I even had my high school social 30 teacher accused me of that right in the middle of class. We were talking about the Trotskyites that were espousing communist ideals back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and how they would corner Christian capitalists and get them to realize that they were hypocritical about their beliefs. And then he turned to me, because of course I was the nerd wearing the Do You See Jesus t-shirts or Christ, you know, Resist Truth Decay, you know, all those cheesy Christian t-shirts. Yeah, I was one of those. So he knew that I was a Christian. So he, of course, turned right to me and said, Jordan, how can you sleep at night? What do you mean? It's like, how can you sleep knowing that you are sleeping on probably $150 or $500 mattress and there are kids starving in Africa? I sleep rather well, thank you. I sleep just fine. Well, Jesus said, you must sell everything you have and give it to the poor. To which I had to remind him that he said that to one man. One man in one story, taken out of context, but that could easily, we could go down that road. Fill ourselves with guilt. You should not have Starbucks. Save your Starbucks money. You can help feed the children in Africa. And although that might be a good gesture, doing it out of guilt isn't necessarily the right thing. Nor should it be legalism. My second lesson that we can pull out of this is balance. First is that compassion will be costly.
The second is balance. Do what you can when you can, but you cannot do everything. Do what you can when you can, but you cannot do everything. If you try to do everything, you will not sleep. You will not eat. You will not have clothes. You will not have a car. You'll have nothing. Because the needs of the world are great. But if as a community of believers, if as the church, we all pitch in, we all contribute, we all do a balanced giving and being generous and showing compassion to those who are in need, how great can the impact on the world be? Balance. Third one is this. I mentioned before about how Jesus reversed the rules. And I think he did that intentionally. Because I think if the lawyer, the legal scholar had sat there and looked at a Jew had helped a Samaritan, he would have once again reverted back to what is the minimum standard I must do to meet the requirements of the law. I don't think Jesus is interested in doctrine. I think he's interested in dynamic Christians. I think he wants the motive of our hearts change. It's not about meeting minimum standards. It's not about setting rules. It's not about if you find somebody who is in need, here's the minimum you need to spend. It's not about looking at this story going, you know what? As long as you find someone in need and spend $300, you've done it. Good on you. You've met the requirement. That's not the point. The point of the story was this. That somebody showed mercy and compassion to another person who was both incapable and unwilling to show gratitude and mercy back. Mercy and compassion was shown to somebody in full knowledge that that person was incapable and unwilling to show gratitude and compassion back. But isn't that exactly what Christ has done for us? That we who were yet sinners, that Christ showed compassion and mercy to me in a place and in a time when I was unwilling and unable to show it back. And so what is giving to the needy? Who is your neighbor? Showing compassion and mercy and meeting the needs of those who may not ever show gratitude, who may continue to be your enemies, who may wake up in disgust that one of the stupid people helped him, that he would rather have died than received your aid, that will never turn back. You might be in reverse position. That person may never show you mercy and kindness. That is not the point. We are to show compassion and mercy because Christ has shown us compassion and mercy. What needs are you not seeing? What needs are you choosing not to see? Because I am very much often like that priest. My innate nature is selfish. To the core. If you don't believe me, ask Andrea. I would so much be more willing to walk by the other side. And yet Jesus says, go and do likewise. The word do that Jesus uses in the Greek is something called a present imperative. It's a very specific word. It's not just go and do likewise once. It's not go and do likewise every now and then. The word is very strongly specific. Go and do like the Samaritan all the time. Every day, every hour, every second, show mercy and kindness. Meet the needs. And be prepared to have it cost you something. Let it be costly compassion.